The Source is made possible in part by a grant from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.
This is The Source, a production of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm Eileen Pace. We're celebrating Black History Month this week, and in doing some research, I found some facts that surprised me a little bit, not the least of which is the low percentage of African Americans among our population here in San Antonio. I heard from some people that it's a little strange living here because of those numbers, but some of those same people also said San Antonio is a welcoming community to all ethnic groups, and many have found a comfortable home here because of that inclusive attitude. San Antonio is fortunate also to have attracted some of the country's best scholars, researchers, educators, and business people from the Black community, who stand as great role models to students and children. Two of these best of the best are here with us today on The Source. Joining me in the TPR studios today are Dr. Erlanda Williams from the UT Health Science Center, former City Councilman Art Hall, who is now Dean of Workforce Development and Continuing Education at St. Philip's College. So welcome, both of you. Dr. Williams, you have a considerable list of honors, having received your Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry from Texas State University in 2002, and you've recently received your PhD in Molecular Immunology, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
And that was just 2009 from UT Health Science Center.
Uh-huh.
But you're not from San Antonio.
No, I'm not. I'm actually from a very small town about 100 miles from here, Flatonia, Texas. And so I got my high school education there, and then I moved on to Texas State University, which was Southwest Texas when I was there. So go Bobcats. And finished there in 2002. I played basketball while I was there. And then, really had a knack for science and knew that I wanted to go in some route of science and was exposed to research while I was there. And so that's how I ended up here at the Health Science Center to get my PhD.
Art Hall is with me in the studio as well today. He's a fifth-generation Texan with roots in East Texas and Lubbock. Mr. Hall has a BA from Harvard University, a Juris Doctor and MBA from Texas Tech, and also an LLM from the University of Wales. That's a little bit different. You kind of are global with your with your expertise and with your pursuits. In 1999, Art was one of the San Antonio Business Journal's top 40 under 40 rising stars. And he did some interesting things politically in San Antonio, which is a big reason that I wanted to have you here. But you're also Dean of Continuing Education at St. Philip's College. So I think that, you know, the relevance of how San Antonians are responding in terms of diversity and how hard it may be or easy it may be here as opposed to other communities for a young Black person to make their way. I had just spoken with a student who's a senior now at UTSA. She's studying history. And, you know, we were talking about this, how she has found so much less opportunity in San Antonio. Fewer programs, fewer ways for Black students to be mentored. And she mentioned that whole concept of taking someone by the hand and pulling them along, and sometimes that's what it takes. And so she created this Black Student Leadership Council in order to mentor other students to do that. Art, how have you found that at St. Philip's?
Well, St. Philip's is certainly a bit of a different environment just because it is a historically Black college or university and also Hispanic serving. We're the only college in the country that's designated federally by both. So it's a great environment for me as an African-American, number one, because we have a president, Dr. Lawson, who's African-American, and she is a tremendous leader. And we've got a great set of leaders under her. I'm one of those. But to be under her leadership and have that mentorship, I think, is a wonderful opportunity for me. Citywide, I think it is a little bit different. We do have an African-American population here of about 6%. And so it's fairly small. I'm married, and I think San Antonio in general is known as a great place for couples and families.
Families, right.
And I find that certainly to be true. I think for either younger people or single people, as an African-American, I think it'd be a little bit more difficult. But generally in the political realm, I found that being in a city with a small African-American population, there is an easy opportunity to make a name for yourself and to be involved at a fairly high level. And so I saw that certainly in politics. I think the difficulty with that is on the other side is that there are very few mentors that can guide you. So when I ran for mayor for the first time in 2001 and when I ran for city council in 2003, I had very few people that I could turn to for mentorship in those positions. And so you'd really have to be a person that's willing to take the initiative on your own and push forward without a big set of mentorship, which you might find in a Houston or a Dallas or in Atlanta, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
And so how did you do it? And you accomplished a great deal. I mean, you ran for mayor and came in third in a field of how many, 11? But the only other two who beat you were the ones who were already sitting on city council.
Right.
So, and you ran in a predominantly Anglo district?
Well, when I ran for mayor first, of course, it was citywide. And so just making a name for myself and having a strong background, I think the background helped a lot. And I did very well in the debates. And so I gained credibility fairly fast. I think when you see folks that are running, a lot of times they don't have much credibility. And so the people that were running ahead of me both were on city council, so that was automatic credibility. And so I had to figure out how to maneuver myself into that sort of position. And so it was a matter of making sure people knew what my background was, but also doing well in the debates.
Mm-hmm. And so when you ran for council, though, you ran in a predominantly Anglo district.
That's right.
Also Hispanic district?
No, predominantly Anglo.
And so what was the percentage of black representation in that district at that time?
And I don't remember the percentages. It was probably around 4%, mm-hmm. 3 or 4%. So District 8 was my district, and the center was I-10. So we were the only district that's completely outside of 410. So I was from Medical Center all the way out to the Dominion. Mm-hmm. So it was a fairly conservative area, but also very progressive. And so for me, again, it was just a matter of making sure that people knew what my background was, that I was a credible candidate.
And you had developed some strength in that through the mayoral race.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So, and then I did have some mentors, including Judge Wolf was one of my mentors at the time, as well as others. But it helped to have some name recognition behind a newcomer to the political arena here.
And Arlinda, you're mentioning earlier that you also are mentoring students.
Sure.
This is a very important thing, don't
Absolutely.
You think?
I mean, I think it's very important that, you know, when you have a goal in sight and you see somebody that is on that track or is doing it, you know, just to have that valuable resource to go talk to them and get their input, you know, find out what struggles and hardships they went through to get there. It's just very important that, you know, you can go talk to them and use them as a resource. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important to be a mentor. And, you know, speaking of mentorship, I think that's how I got started. I've had absolutely amazing mentors all the way through my academic career. And, you know, starting from the time I was, you know, 3 or 4 years old, my aunt, who was actually an instructor at St. Philip College, she started me, you know, I was reading by age 3, and she started me just, you know, doing all the things that were basically profound to get a very good education and move on and move forward with, you know, what I wanted to do in life. And from there, you know, I had really good teachers that I took hold to in high school and then got to undergrad. And like I said, I ran into Dr. Ron Walter, who was an excellent mentor, set me up here at the Health Science Center, and my PhD mentor, Dr. Ellen Craig, who is still, I consider, one of my mentors, has been very helpful in just, you know, leading me in the right path for my career goals. And it's just been a wonderful experience.
What are you doing right now in terms of mentoring others?
So I'm actually a student mentor for the dental school. So I teach gross anatomy to dental school students, PT and PA students, and the dental school actually has a program where, you know, you can decide to be a mentor to some of the incoming students. I have not in the last year, but previously in years prior, I was a mentor for high school and undergraduate students who wanted to do research projects in Dr. Ellen Craig's labs. And so I would take them along and mentor them and, you know, teach them how to, you know, go into a lab and do a project and whatnot. And then I'm also now president of the Women's Faculty Association.
Mm-hmm.
And each year we sponsor a program where we go into all the junior highs and high schools that participate in the Alamo Regional Science Fair, and we actually give out awards to those students who, you know, do very good science projects. And so we have kind of a program there where they can see, you know, this is the next step. You start the science projects in junior high and high school, you go on to undergrad, and then, you know, you can eventually be, you know, you can go into academia or into clinical sciences and work at a health science center and whatnot.
Nothing is impossible, but that some minority individuals may have to work a little bit harder or a lot harder to get the same thing. Do you think that that is still a truism after all these years? It's still holding true?
I think it is true still in some regards. I mean, I don't think all the barriers have been completely broken.
Okay.
And I think part of the reason why is because, you know, maybe the students and the people now have that opportunity, but their parents may not have.
So Artemisia Bowden Day is coming up. Tell me what that is. First of all, who is Mrs. Bowden?
So, first, St. Philip's was founded in 1898, and Miss Bowden became the principal at the time. It was started as a cooking and sewing school for recently emancipated African American girls. And so, 1898, there were six girls that were at the school, and Miss Bowden came to be the principal of the school in 1902. Eventually, it became a private junior college, and she became president of the private junior college. There was a time period there where St. Philip's Episcopal Church had to choose between TMI, which still is an entity here in San Antonio, and St. Philip's, which is now a college. And during the Depression, they didn't have enough money to run both, so they chose to keep TMI. So it was Miss Bowden who kept St. Philip's alive.
And how did she do that?
She did it with her own family. She did it with her own money, and she just kept pushing the school by herself and with her family.
And the goats and the chickens.
Exactly.
Tell me about the goats and the chickens.
Well, you have to leave those stories to Dr. Lawson. She knows all of those stories. But it remained a private junior college for a time period. Then eventually it became part of the municipal junior college system in 1942. And so she retired in, I believe it was 1954. She served as either president or dean or principal at St. Philip's for 52 years.
Well, I just want to interject that Dr. Lawson has told me that story, and it's I don't know all the details, but just a quick version of it is that when the two split, TMI and the church, and they had to raise money somehow, and so she raised goats and she raised chickens and they sold eggs and they went door to door and knocked on doors to sell that livestock, and people would buy it.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Lawson knows all the history of St. Philip's, so it's wonderful to hear.
Was that out in the country back then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that was like far out of town.
Right, exactly, exactly. So that's who Miss Bowden is. The St. Philip's was actually founded on March 1st, and so we're having our celebration there on campus on March 1st, and I think it's that same day that we're going to Bowden Elementary School to celebrate with them. So lots of festivities, lots of people coming in to help celebrate with us. And so it's just a great time to celebrate who Miss Bowden is and what she's meant to St. Philip, certainly, but to the larger community as well.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. It'll be a little extension of Black History Month, right?
Yes, ma'am.
We've been speaking with Orlando Williams and Art Hall about some of the issues going on in San Antonio regarding the Black community and help that African-American students and children can get and get mentoring and things that are available to them in the city of San Antonio. I'm Eileen Pace, and you're listening to The Source. And when we come back, more info on some special Black History Month celebrations. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Eileen Pace. We continue our conversation now about triumphs and challenges among San Antonio's African-American community. One observation by a UTSA history major is that San Antonio had fewer resources for Black students when she arrived a few years ago. So she set out to change that. Now she's written a play about new ethnic cultural perspectives and the changing attitudes of Black leadership. It is the first play ever to be presented by UTSA in honor of Black History Month.
Here in the midst of ignorance and hurt are people filled with endless hope.
This is hoping. Not a play about all the past. Victoria Garrett said hoping. It's more forward-looking, giving young Black students hope for their future, reflected against events of the past. Garrett is from Houston, which enjoys a greater percentage of Black students in its population and at its colleges. But Garrett came to study at UTSA, and upon her arrival joined the Black Student Union.
There is a culture here at UTSA for not just Hispanic. People think that it's just a Hispanic serving, you know, university because it is in San Antonio, but UTSA prides itself in diversity of all students, and so we wanted to kind of show them that we are here and we are diverse.
But Garrett sought to tackle what she perceived as an underrepresentation for Black student leaders in San Antonio. She founded the Black Student Leadership Council at UTSA.
We have a mentoring program with high school seniors at Wagner High School here in San Antonio, as well as mentoring our freshmen, because UTSA's retention rate, it has gotten a lot better, but we did have a very bad retention rate, even lower for Black students. And so we wanted to kind of bring them in and say, okay, this is what you need to do. And then if you have leadership qualities, or you think you may have leadership qualities, then that's kind of what we want to do and kind of nurture that.
Garrett says the group has had a positive impact on retention rates among Black students. But she says younger Black students today often have a different view of racial division. In fact, she says oftentimes, even far back in history, race has not really been the main issue.
We've kind of, and I know even in the BSLC, we've had those discussions where, and I'm a history major, so my whole degree is research. And the more I research in all these racial issues and everything, the more I see it really wasn't about race. Like, we have internalized that as something that we know, but it's never been about race. If we see from even from the slave trades all the way till now, when we see the presidential election, and we're so quick to jump on the bandwagon and say it's a racial issue. Well, it's an economic issue. A lot of people didn't care for Bill Clinton, not because he was white, but he was from a poor neighborhood. He wasn't rich. He wasn't born into anything. He had to work. He had to, you know what I'm saying? And so he was able to identify with that. And that's why a lot of Democrats and minorities praise him, because he could understand who they were, even though he was white.
And he understood being poor.
He had to work hard to get where he was. Mm-hmm.
This weekend, the BSLC presents Our Reigns Reclaimed, a theatrical production written by Garrett. She says the mission of an underrepresented group and acceptance that some people have to work a little harder to get what they want does not mean they have to give up.
Or will it reflect how we change the world positively? Will our future's children be bombarded with our accomplishments or our downfalls? Will we be honored with the idea of freedom or despised for our self-inflicted mental bondage? Their history starts now.
The play is this Saturday evening, February 11th at UTSA's Recital Hall at 6 p.m. Admission is free. One way to get more familiar with Black History Month is to take a trip downtown Saturday to the Institute of Texan Cultures. The Bexar County Buffalo Soldiers Association and the Buffalo Soldiers Living History and Heritage Association are collaborating with Texas Parks and Wildlife this Saturday for Buffalo Soldiers Day. The Bexar County Buffalo Soldiers Association and the Buffalo Soldiers Living History and Heritage Association are collaborating with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department this Saturday for Buffalo Soldiers Day. 186,000 Black soldiers participated in the Civil War, with 38,000 killed in action. But they were classified as volunteers, not as U.S. military. The Buffalo soldiers were the first African-American soldiers allowed to enlist in the U.S. military after the Civil War. Luis Padilla is with Texas Parks and Wildlife.
The exceptional part about it is these were men who had to face a lot. A lot of them coming from being former slaves, or coming from a household that was a slave family. Even though the Civil War had ended, they were now in Texas and westward, where you still had some resistance to the freeing of the slaves and states' rights.
After African Americans were freed, Congress recognized the military merits of the Black soldiers that had been serving by authorizing 2 regiments of Black cavalry and 6 new infantry regiments.
They were led by white officers at first. You didn't have your first Black officer until Henry O. Flipper graduated from West Point. In 1866, when the act was passed, in 1867, when they formed, they were first led by white officers. A private and that's just starting, just getting enlisted, would make anywhere up to about $13 a month. And as you started showing, you can take on responsibility and you were learning more, they would move you up in rank. So you would make ranks such as corporal and sergeant, and et cetera.
Most were sent west to fight Indian wars.
You'll get a lot of mixed emotions and feelings and opinions when discussing this war, because I'm sure you had, some kind of thought to it as, we're a citizen now and now we're, doing what was done to us, basically, to the Native Americans now. But again, they were U.S. soldiers, so they were having to follow orders, just like anybody who enlisted in the Army, whether black, white, or brown.
Padilla said this year's exhibit has an emphasis on outdoor skills in a larger and more interactive program.
You'll have orienteering or compass tracking station, so we can show what the soldiers had to do before technology and hopefully pass that skill along to interest people in going outdoors. We'll also have an animal tracking station because some soldiers partook in hunting parties, and you picked up the skills on how to track animals and how to spot animals that were around your camp or what kind of movement was around you.
Padilla hopes Saturday's exhibit encourages visitors to remember Buffalo soldiers for their bravery and their legacy, protecting the settlers moving westward.
And again, these are contributions from strong men and women that need to be recognized, that need to be remembered, Black History Month itself. You hear, you'll see a lot of things pertaining to just slavery. Well, why not talk about a hero? Why not talk about these brave men who set out west into areas and situations they've never seen or been through before? Let's honor them. Let's remember that story.
It should also be noted that women contributed tremendously to the war effort in the 1870s. Even though they were still not allowed to join the Army, one woman did. Kathy Williams is the only documented female to become an enlisted member of the military. But she had to do it by cutting her hair, changing her name, and doing whatever was necessary to conceal her gender. Padilla said Kathy changed her name to William Kathy and was known as Private Kathy. Annie said that she was quite tall, taller than most men at that time, which went a long way toward making her disguise a success. To help guests understand the importance of black soldiers in the formation of the United States, and especially the Southwest, the Institute of Texan Cultures will open its gates from 10 to 4 on Saturday. Families are welcome, and there are lots of kids' activities, too. To learn more about Black History Month events going on in February, go to our website at tpr.org, where you can also hear this program again. You've been listening to The Source on KSTX. We get production help from Andrea Liao. Our web producer is Albert Salazar. The website is tpr.org. The Source is also available on iTunes. Wayne Coble is the KSTX program director. I'm Eileen Pace, and The Source is a production of Texas Public Radio.